Welcome to Fathoming Water. I'm your host, Melissa Mosey. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed our first episode with Sharon Megdahl, and I greatly appreciate her taking the time to come in and start off Fathoming Water right. Today, we've got another excellent guest for you. His name is Robert Glennon. He's a Regents Professor and Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. Robert Glennon teaches water law and American legal history of the Colorado River. Glennon is the recipient of two National Science Foundation grants and serves as an advisor to governments, corporations, think tanks, law firms, and NGOs. He has written two books, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It, and he has written Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping and the Fate of America's Fresh Waters. He received a JD from Boston College Law School and an MA and PhD in American History from Brandeis University. What's most interesting about Glennon's work is that while it's based in history, and specifically legal history, he's looking forward to the future of water that will involve markets. Markets are a nuanced subject. They are often hard to wrap your head around, especially if you're a person who thinks, why put a price on water? Water is an essential human right. We all need it to live. We all need it to grow food, and we all need it in our daily lives. Putting a price on water is a very difficult decision in places like Bolivia or Argentina, where the poor and disenfranchised often come out worse off, while those who are wealthy profit from the sale of water to poorer communities. Businesses who profit off water are often criticized, and there can be a great deal of social injustice in pricing water. However, markets can also serve a function. They've served a function in Australia and in California during times of drought. A lot of trades we will see involve farmer-to-farmer trades. A farmer with a crop that lasts several years, such as a tree, is willing to pay more for water than a farmer who has an annual crop, such as alfalfa. What Robert Glennon will expand on today is how trades of water operate in the United States specifically. Most of our time will be taken discussing how farmers trade water to other farmers, or how farmers trade water to the industrial sector. He makes a very good point that the business community is not paying enough attention to water. Places such as Google and others are using water in the form of electricity. But today we focus on mostly farming in the U.S., and how places like California, who are experiencing extreme drought right now, are using market tools to change the way business is done and to reallocate water to the people that need it most. And now, Robert Glennon. Today I'm talking with Robert Glennon. Robert Glennon has written two popular books for the general public about water. And my first question is, why should the general public know about water?
Well, because it's the essence of life. Without it, we don't exist. The problem in the United States, though, Melissa, is, as you know so well, we take water for granted. Most of us, when we wake up in the morning, we turn on the tap, and out comes as much water as we want for less than we pay for cell phone service or for cable television. When we think about water, we think of it as being like the air. Infinite and inexhaustible, when for all practical purposes, it's very finite and quite exhaustible.
The reason that I asked you in specifically today is because you teach over at the university and you teach a course on American legal history of the Colorado River, but you also do a lot of research on markets, and a lot of your current work is talking about water markets. It's a talking point that's come up before with Sharon Megdahl in the previous episode, and it's going to come up in many later episodes as well. What I really want to get out of this is how that legal history has set us up for markets and some of the challenges that the legal history that's already in place obstructs market development?
Yeah, that's a good question, Melissa. Well, in the American West, for surface water, the states developed what's called the prior appropriation doctrine. And what that basically meant in the 19th century was first come, first serve. So it was a great rule to incentivize people to do something with water, but it was indiscriminate as to whether what they were doing was very important or very valuable, or even whether they were using so much water that they weren't using it wisely or efficiently. But that's the rule that's in place, and it remains in place. And so people who use surface water have rights by virtue of the date when they began the use. The older the use, the more senior the right, the more valuable the right. So that's the historical paradigm, but in the 21st century, what that means is that we have a lot of water being used for very low-value crops. We have, for example, flood irrigation of millions of acres of land in the West to grow alfalfa, which doesn't generate all that much money for the farmers. And the problem with the rules of prior appropriation and a bunch of other doctrines we can get into if you'd like is that the rules make it very difficult for those senior appropriators to transfer their rights to either lease or sell the rights to someone else to use it.
You have a new paper out called Shopping for Water, How the Market Can Mitigate Water Shortages in the American West. And you identify five legal restraints or legal concepts from the past that are a problem for going forward into the future. Some of them are the beneficial use. Some of them are you're talking about senior water rights affecting junior water rights, that no harm can come to junior water right holders if they were to transfer the water, the anti-speculation doctrine. So talk about some of these doctrines and how they are creating barriers in a little more detail.
So one of the important principles of Western water law is that all water needs to be used beneficially. And beneficial is a term of art, but it's very comprehensive. In the early 20th century, the thought was that if you didn't use water, you were wasting water, which to modern ears seems very peculiar. But that's the way it was put by President Herbert Hoover when he talked about any drop of water that reaches the sea unused is a wasted drop of water. Well, today, of course, we know that that water is serving lots of environmental ecosystem purposes. It's protecting habitat and so on. But that was the metaphor. And the way that that plays out for water rights holders is if you don't use the water that you have a right to use, you may lose the water right. It may be deemed abandoned or forfeited. So it's a very strange rule that disincentivizes users of water from making a more efficient use of the water, because if they do so, they may not benefit from that. Instead, they may actually lose their water rights to the water that they've saved.
Now, in terms of water rights, let's back up a little and talk about private property rights, because this all comes down to the idea of property and water being property associated with the land and how that's changed through time.
It's true. It's not an ownership right. In other words, in the United States, no one owns the water. The water is a public resource. It's owned by the state. But the state has given rights to use water, and those are use rights, and they are indeed property rights. In the state of Utah, for example, water rights are conveyed by a deed, just as you might convey your house. If you sold your house, there'd be a deed that you'd give the new purchaser of your house. So it's a use right, but it's subject to government rules and regulations. And that's a very important limit on the right, because that makes it different than many other kinds of property. One can't imagine the government telling you that you can't sell your house, but one can imagine the government putting limits on the ability of people to sell water.
In part, is that because water and when you move water, when you sell water, there is an aspect to moving water that requires infrastructure, that requires environmental regulations or passing through environmental regulations?
That's certainly part of it, Melissa. I think it's also that water is different. Water is a public resource, and it plays a very special role in allowing human beings to exist. Going without water for a few days and you're going to die. And that makes it a critical resource and one where you need to think about water in terms of it being a basic right to life, a human right. And in the writings that I've done, particularly in my book Unquenchable, I've tried to articulate a human right to water, because that's just simply the right thing to do. It's also because if the richest country in the history of the world, the United States, cannot make that commitment to its people, then that's a fairly sad state of affairs. But the truth is that there is essentially a human right to water in the United States. We have a very proud tradition of public control over the resource and a system of pipes and valves that supply water to about 85% of the people in the United States through, for example, here in Tucson, Tucson Water, a municipal water department that provides water. There are basic fees for that, but they're very modest indeed, and we provide high-quality water for an incredibly low price, and we should be proud of that.
And we also have something progressive at Tucson Water, which is the increase in amount you pay based on an increase in water use.
Yes. I'm a very big fan of Tucson Water. I think it's a well-run utility. I think that the department responds well to consumer interest and input.
There's a strong ethic here. Now, I'm glad that you brought up the fact that we value water as a human right, because as we move into our conversation about markets, one of the greatest concerns when you talk about markets about water is, will the poor, will the disenfranchised people of the world be negatively impacted by markets?
And I think it depends on where you are and what the current state of affairs is. So let's divide it into two. Let's take the United States second. So globally, it's a terrible state of affairs. More than 1 billion of the 7 billion people on Earth lack adequate water. One out of seven, a billion people. So that's a real problem. And there have been challenges when the private sector has tried to come in and to build a system of pipes and valves that would provide water to currently to people who don't have it. Not surprisingly, in places like Bolivia, South Africa, Namibia, what you see is that the private company wants to provide water to people whom it know will be able to repay the costs that the company has put in building the pipes and valves. And that creates a problem, no doubt about it, because the more wealthy will get the service from the company and the less fortunate will have to pay more for water, because there will be cottage industries of people with trucks and big tanks on the back of the truck who go around and dole out water almost by the bucketful, and that's a very pricey way to pay for water. In the United States, though, we have much better government control and management over water. Tucson Water, of course, is actually part of the city, so it's subject to the control of the mayor and council. Other parts of Arizona, the water is provided by a private corporation regulated by the Arizona Corporation Commission. In other states, this would be called the Public Utilities Commission or maybe the Public Service Commission. So that's a state agency, sometimes elected, sometimes appointed by the governor, that controls this monopoly privilege of the water provider or the gas provider or the electric company. And they set rules and regulations for how the company must act. And that's why I think we have a much fairer system for distributing water. Next point I'd like to make picks up on your point that we charge progressively for water. The more you use, the more you pay. And I just think that that's as important a principle as one could imagine. So as I go around talking to groups all around, the U.S. and beyond, I meet inventors and engineers who have built better water mousetraps, things that will work, that will save water. But what is so sad, really sad, is that almost to a person, none of these entrepreneurs have a viable business model because the price of water is just too darn low. Why should someone pay $700 for a smart irrigation timer for their backyard when the water bill is $30 a month?
It doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense. And the price of water is just a huge disincentive to conserve. If you're not paying much for it, you don't think too much about it. And it's even worse in some places, Melissa. At least here, we have meters and everyone pays something. In some places, the rates actually are decreasing block rates, meaning the more water you use, the less you pay for that final unit of water. Well, that's just simply bizarre. And there are other places, such as Sacramento and Fresno, where the city has fought against having water meters at all. And as we sit here this afternoon, about half of the capital city of California, Sacramento, has homes with no water meters.
In a state that is facing some of the most significant water challenges to date.
It's incredibly ironic. And you cannot manage what you do not measure. Then you can have sensible policies for the use of the resource.
I think one of the reasons that markets are a possibility to solving water crisis in places like the U.S. and Australia is they're not a truly free market. It is a regulated market, a heavily regulated market that you're discussing, where the state is involved. In some cases, some of the water banks, the states are the customers, the only customers.
I think that's a fair comment on it, but I'm in favor of regulation because water is a public resource and because the market can have failures and trading water rights may produce a windfall for the person who owns the water right, usually a farmer. But what about the farm workers? Or what about the farming community, the larger farming community? So if the farmer sells out his water rights, then what about the John Deere dealer or the fertilizer and pesticide supplier or the businesses that are processing the food that the farmer was growing? All of those people are part of a very interconnected web. And so economists would call these impacts on third parties externalities. They are costs generated by an actor, but not paid for by the actor. And so in my writing, what I've argued for is there should be government oversight of any significant transfer in order to require the transferor to internalize these costs. The same might be said also from Melissa for the environment, because some transfers are going to mean that there's less water in the river downstream and there will be consequences for the environment. That's another kind of cost that I think government regulation should internalize.
Now, we talk about senior and junior water rights. Where does the environment sit? We know about the Nature Conservancy.
It doesn't. I mean, there's been over the last generation an effort to create what are called in-stream flows, which would take their place in line. But those are mostly junior rights. But I'd like to make two points. One, sometimes I'm asked the question, well, golly, if you're selling and buying water rights, the environment won't be a participant. Well, that's true. But in the change that I'm talking about, there will be no increase in the use of water. It's already being used by someone, not by the environment, but by someone to grow crops or to produce an industrial product or whatever. What I'm trying to avoid by encouraging us to reallocate existing water is the alternative. And the alternative means more diversions of water from already threatened rivers or more drilling of groundwater wells from regions where the water table in the aquifer is already going down. So I see markets as a way of alleviating these environmental harms.
The best example I can think of this style of using markets to help the environment is Australia. Australia recently faced a 15-year drought, significant impacts, and I still get emails where they say, these trades have been made today. They have a very viable market, and then the government purchases water for the environment.
It's true. I spent several months on sabbatical in Australia in 2012. But let's not get too carried away with the great things that Australia is doing. One of the things that Australia has done beautifully is to distinguish between the amount of water that is diverted from the amount of water that is consumed, and they give you a right to trade the consumptive part of the use. In the United States, though, if you go to transfer a water right, anyone who is on the system who is junior to you may object to the transfer and require you to show that she will not be harmed by your transfer. Well, you may be able to do that, but as you can imagine, it would be a very cumbersome, time-consuming process, which would tremendously drive up the costs, or what economists would call the transaction costs would be astronomical. And so that you just don't do deals. But what Australia has done is simply said, if you have been consuming five, you have a right to transfer it, no questions asked, because that five was being consumed. The other five that you diverted but didn't use, well, that stays in the system. But the consumptive part, you can transfer. And that's something we argue in shopping for water we should do in the United States. On the other hand, the limit in Australia is it's basically the government buying water for the environment, which I think is a good thing, but that's not much of a market. I mean, it's retiring agricultural water rights in the Murray Darling to protect the environment. A wonderful thing, but it's really not a reallocation from Farmer A to Google or Intel or Amazon.
Okay, so one of the things that came up in your article and seems to be the case with markets here. Now, there is a market in California, and it's mostly farmer-to-farmer trades, usually deals with agricultural water going to municipalities are independent, larger deals, it would appear. Is that the
yes,
case?
Yes, yeah. Gary Leibkap, one of my co-authors, and I did a National Science Foundation study on water markets in the West a few years ago, and there's a lot of trading going on, but most trades are small trades between one farmer and another farmer. The big trades tend to be from farming into municipal, industrial, or sometimes to the environment. I mean, there are big pieces of water that have been purchased for the environment.
And do you see that as an effective way to mitigate externalities and to bring the cost back to the people that are causing harm?
Well, I think it is. I mean, they're driven partly by the Endangered Species Act.
So the threat of litigation.
Yes, and the hammer of the Endangered Species Act to bring about change in behavior.
I want to talk about the specifics of California, because when you wrote this paper, the 2013 to 2014 winter, the snowpack in the Sierra Nevadas was 25%. Do you know the numbers for the snowpack for this past winter?
Less.
Even less.
Even less. Yeah, it's been just an absolutely horrible drought. There are more than 500,000 acres of ag land that were fallowed into the 2014-2015 year. And maybe we'll get a big El Nino. Some scientists are thinking it's going that way. Maybe not. But even if there's a good El Nino this year, the reservoirs are still very low, and it's certainly not going to end the drought.
With the farmers that are experiencing not being able to have water, having to fallow land, you mentioned the fact that other people, John Deere, everything is affected down the line in terms of prices of food, people not being able to work. But also, I noticed in your article, Shopping for Water, that things like insurance rates can be affected. The interest on loans to small farmers can be affected.
It's quite stunning how little attention the major business community has paid to water. And in Shopping for Water, we try to open a few eyes with that. I expect most of your listeners would not think about companies like Google or Facebook or Amazon being big water consumers, but they are. And the reason why they're consuming a lot of water is because of the cloud. It's all about the energy to drive searches, whether it's a Google search or it's a Facebook exchange or it's a YouTube video that's been posted. We seem to have an insatiable interest in accessing data over the web, and that's done in what are called data centers, which are hard brick-and-mortar buildings that house tens of thousands of computers, each generating heat. They need to be air-cooled. That's air-conditioned, and that's done with water. So these high-tech companies, the highest of high-tech possible, are actually enormous consumers of both electricity and water. And yet the business community doesn't seem to be paying too much attention to water. And that really needs to change.
That is true that we have an energy-water nexus. And I think we're going to have a future episode where we really get in depth on that energy-water nexus. People often don't think that when they turn on a light bulb, they're literally using water.
Right.
And that is a larger issue and maybe one for another episode in the future. But I'm glad you brought it up. And but I do want to talk about the nitty-gritty of what goes on when a farmer trades water to another farmer.
Well, it depends on where the farmers are. Sometimes that trade might be of a surface water right to a river in Montana, and the downstream farmer wants to expand alfalfa production and buy some water from the upstream farmer. That's pretty simple. The upstream farmer just doesn't divert as much. The downstream farmer diverts more. Some trades involve groundwater. And here in Arizona, we have the capacity to trade groundwater rights, particularly what are called Type 2 rights. And that could be anywhere in the Tucson Basin. A Type 2 right is sold to someone else who gets a right to use that water in the basin. In other places around the West, it could be within the boundaries of an irrigation district. And in that case, Melissa, it depends on the district bylaws and rules that govern the relationship between not only the district and the federal agency, the Bureau of Reclamation, but also between the district and the individual growers. So it's a kind of nuanced picture. But if I may, I'd like to pick up on that question and make a comment. About 3 years ago, Peter Culp, another of my co-authors, and I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal pointing out that in the middle of this drought in California, California farmers had used about 100 billion gallons of water to grow alfalfa that was then shipped to China. And we thought this was a very kind of catchy way to show that there's something wrong with a system where the Federal Commerce Department and the state agriculture departments encourage the export of crops, but they make it virtually impossible for the farmer domestically to not use that water and instead to sell or lease that water to a thirsty farmer next door or to a nearby city. So we wanted to expand the market by removing some of the impediments. Right now, in many irrigation districts, if a farmer does not use that water, the farmer does not benefit from that. The farmer cannot sell or lease it. And we think that's a shame. So one of the things that I'm working on would be a fund. The structure could be a public-private partnership. It could be simply a fund created either by Congress or by the California legislature, let's say $500 million. And that $500 million would then be used to pay for the modernization of farm infrastructure. Right now in California, there are millions of acres of land irrigated with flood irrigation. Well, that's very inefficient. And there's an Israeli company that's now in the United States called Netafim USA. And Netafim has pioneered in what is called subsurface drip irrigation. It's a terrific system. It works. It produces more of the product, and it uses less water doing so. But here's the rub. It's expensive. It may cost as much as $2,500 or $3,000 an acre to install subsurface drip. And if you have 500 acres on the farm, that's a heck of a lot of money. And let's face it, it's way beyond the means of many farmers. Farmers often are land rich and cash poor. And so what I would like to see is the municipal and industrial sector pay to modernize farm infrastructure. In turn, the farmers would grow the same amount of product with slightly less water, and the water saved would go to the municipal and industrial sector. I mean, the problem we have to figure out for markets is this: how do we protect the integrity of rural America? Because what we don't want happening is simply rich cities coming in and buying up all the water rights and destroying the backbone of rural America. We want to protect that. In some ways, for just a very selfish reason, they're providing us food.
I could see where security. If the water becomes so valuable, you retire all your land and just keep selling, and
that's
then
right.
Where are you? Are you still a farmer?
Right. And so I want to see us protect rural America, and my system would do so, because it only would take a small reduction in ag consumption to fix the municipal and industrial sector problem. A 4% reduction in ag consumption translates into almost a 50% increase in the water available for municipal and industrial use.
And that is because the historic use of agriculture is so large.
So large, yeah. It's above 80% in some states.
Well, Sharon pointed out that the acre foot is only used in the American West, and it literally means to flood the land. Our language
yes.
is so completely tied to these ideas of just spreading the water out on the land as much as possible.
That's it. That's our history. And so we need to figure out how this can happen, and some method of private-public partnership or public financing that then you recoup through the people that need the water, paying the government agency that invested this money back for some of the water. That's happened, by the way, in Utah. In Unquenchable, I tell the story about a steel company that went bankrupt at the end of the 20th century, just outside of Provo, where Brigham Young University is. And the Utah equivalent of the Arizona CAP bought the water rights of the steel company. Melissa, they paid $102 million for water rights. $100 million. And this was merely doing the bidding of cities and towns near Salt Lake, who were themselves doing the bidding of developers and business interests in those towns. So at the end of the day, the Utah CAP is going to recoup its entire $102 million by peddling pieces of the water rights that once belonged to the steel company. And that's how it should be, because then what you have is you have the people who want more water paying for it. Right now, the system in many states, including California, is you can drill a well, and pump away to your heart's content. There's no charge for it. You pay only the pumping charge for the costs of the electricity to get the water to the surface. Well, that needs to change. That's just a totally bizarre system. We haven't yet mentioned climate change. And climate change, most scientists think, is going to produce less water in the Southwest. But it also creates real problems for the water managers, because they make predictions about 500-year floods, 100-year floods, 50-year floods, water supply. They make predictions of the future based on the past. The past's no longer a good measurement. And so we have a system that's quite rigid and brittle, and we need to build resiliency into it. And one of the things we call for is the use of risk mitigation strategies. Now, that's a high-floating-sounding term, but really, it's nothing more than insurance. I mean, if you think about insurance, it's mitigating risk, whether it's health insurance, life insurance, or car insurance. If you think about farmers, they're mitigating risk all the time. They're selling futures contracts. They're selling a right now to soybeans in July 2016. And the way they do that is they sell little pieces of their crop at different points in time, so that regardless of whether the commodity price goes up or goes down, they end up with an even amount. So risk mitigation is common in insurance, in stock exchanges, in commodities markets, and we should do the same thing with water. And the example I give is of a broccoli grower who may enter into a dry year lease option with an almond producer. And the difference between broccoli and almonds is broccoli is a row crop. It's an annual. Almonds, of course, grow on trees, and it takes 5 to 7 years before a tree that's planted begins to harvest nuts. Well, if you don't water an almond tree for a year, the whole orchard dies. If you don't water the broccoli for a year, you lose the seasonal crop.
The risk is much
greater.
The
risk is tremendously different. And so it's really important that for the people with the orchards that they be able to secure a supply when there is that drought to mitigate the risk of losing the entire orchard.
So how do they create the trade and create the market place? Because markets really emerge. How is it emerging in California between these broccoli producers and almond producers?
Well, it's definitely happening, but the problem is it's not happening with as much fluidity. Maybe I shouldn't. I didn't intentionally mean to pun that
you
way.
You can't help it, pun water.
No, I always stumble into puns. I'm not smart enough or quick enough to intentionally do that. But more, the deals are being done, but they're very expensive to do. We don't have the same kind of liquidity as we do with stocks. So right now, if you look in the stock market, you can buy a share of Google for X dollars, and it'll be there. And maybe it goes up a dollar or down a dollar, but you know instantly what the value is. And with low-cost firms like Schwab brokerage houses, you can buy stocks for a few bucks. That's not water. Water is going to require that you have a water lawyer. You're going to have a hydrologist. You may need an economist. You're going to have to go through permitting processes. And what we're trying to do in shopping for water is to scrape away some of this underbrush so that willing buyers and willing sellers can get together more easily and more cheaply.
That's the transaction cost.
Correct.
That we were speaking
about
before.
Yeah, absolutely.
A farmer sells the water. Who comes in to make sure that they are not using the water? For instance, groundwater. Surface water you can measure because what comes out of the canal can be measured by some sort of flow meter. But in terms of groundwater, is there a state agency that comes in and makes sure that a farmer is fallowing certain fields or that they've reduced their well usage?
It depends on which state you're talking about. Even with groundwater, there are ways to figure out how much water you're using, and that is through the electric bills. So even if there's no measurement at the pump head that says that the farmer used 200,000 gallons of water, the farmer is going to have an electric bill of, say, $37,504, and you can do some calculations and let you know that when the water table in that area was 80 feet below the surface, the cost of pumping was Y, and therefore you used Z gallons. So you can actually make those calculations.
For instance, does the Arizona Department of Water Resources in Arizona, are they the ones that would come in and double check?
You can have objections filed by other water users. I mean, you can know what DWR has done. They've done some monitoring using satellites. So in the Groundwater Management Act, everyone took a haircut after the 1980 Act, and it was clear that some fields were continuing to be grown, and you could just look at the satellite imagery and tell what crops were being grown and translate that into, if it's cotton, therefore it's 5 acre feet per acre, and you're using too much water. So there are a lot of ways to use satellite imagery to get good data.
Oh, that's interesting. So you've got satellite imagery, you've got electric bills. So
drones.
There are various
drones.
Oh, drones.
Oh, yeah. Drones are becoming a very big deal. And it's starting really by just farmers trying to figure out what's going on in the middle of their field. I mean, if you've got corn stalks that are 7 feet high, how do you know what's going on in the middle of the field? So you know, you get yourself a little drone and send it out there and take a look.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So I think markets are a very critical solution, but they're not the only solution. I think the solution is really a menu of options or portfolio. Marketing will be one. Price signals to encourage conservation will be a second. But let's not overlook simple conservation. That remains the low-hanging fruit. There are a lot of things we can do more efficiently to save the water that we already have. That's water we don't need to go find, we don't need to treat, we just need to use it more wisely. So too, in Tucson especially, we can see how reuse of water is an important solution, another tool in the menu. And we're using water in Tucson for golf courses, highway medians, parks, cemeteries, some light industrial applications. Mines can use reclaimed water sometimes. Google can use reclaimed water for its server farms. So reclaimed water is a really important part of the solution. And for places along the coast or in areas where there was once an inland sea and the aquifer might be brackish, we do have the technology to take salt out of water. So desalinization is another part of the solution going forward. But it's not a silver bullet. There are two specific things that your listeners might do that they wouldn't think too much of or maybe haven't thought too much about. One, the kitchen food disposal. Val Little, who runs Water Casa here in Tucson, did a study that found that if you use a food disposal 2 minutes a day to get rid of food scraps, you may, by the end of the month, use as much as 150 gallons of water just to get rid of food scraps. So stop using your food disposal. Put the food scraps in your compost pile or in the trash. It's better than using all that water. And the second thing is turn off a light. Researchers at Virginia Tech University found that a single 60-watt incandescent bulb may, if you burn it 12 hours a day, use by the end of the year as much as 6,300 gallons of water. Melissa, that's one light, 6,300 gallons. So if your listeners want to save water, turn off a light.
Okay.
But I'm optimistic, very optimistic, because the water crisis in the United States is real, but a crisis allows us an opportunity to act. There's still time to change directions. And we can keep the crisis from becoming a catastrophe, but what we need to do so is to summon the moral courage and the political will to act.
Thank you so much, Robert Glennon. In our next episode, we're going to be talking with several people. It's going to be focused on the Sustainable Water for Southern Arizona Current Conditions and Future Prospects Forum. This water forum is meant for the general public. It's on Friday, November 6th from 7:30 a.m. to 11 a.m. And there will be free parking at the Tucson Convention Center. It will feature Lisa Atkins, the president of the CAP, also the Arizona Department of Water Resources Director Tom Bouchatsky, and a panel moderated by our first guest, Sharon Megdahl. In the next coming weeks, we're going to be speaking with many of these people that are going to be participating in the forum, as well as Lisa Atkins and Tom Bouchatsky. Once again, another chance for the general public to get involved and learn more about water. Thank you so much to Robert Glennon once again for joining us on Fathoming Water In-Depth Discussions. And tune in 2 weeks for our third episode that will feature Lisa Atkins and Tom Bouchatsky. In future episodes, we will also be talking with Diana Liverman of the Institute for the Environment, as well as many others. So keep tuning in to Fathoming Water In-Depth Discussions for more information about water. And thank you so much.